Welcome, everyone. This is the second day of the 78th meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. I'm pleased to be able to reconvene our meeting. First, I would entertain any comments from members.
I'm Bob Budnitz, and the comment is that, boy, that was a really interesting meeting last night about seismic issues at the plant. And it was full of technical information, and we're going to take some time to absorb it. I mean, on our end.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to entertain public comments. Anyone wishing to address the committee on matters not appearing on the agenda may do so only at this time. The public may comment on any matter listed on the agenda immediately following the time the matter is considered by the committee. Do I have any comments at this point from members of the public? Please. And introduce yourself for the record
Sure. So
that we get the transcript. All right. It is correct.
Sure. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. And I'm just going to actually follow up a little bit as a tag on to the end of yesterday evening's comments. Of course,
good.
We all saw that presentation for the first time by PG&E. What I am going to leave you with today, or you may not be aware of, is the legal brief in the most recent PUC filing that deals with cost recovery for the seismic studies. The brief was filed by our attorney, John Giesman, a couple of weeks ago. He's not in the country, was unable to be here today.
It was sent to us, you should know.
Oh, you have it. Okay.
Go on.
Well, in that case, then, let me help the listening audience understand where the basis of my comments were yesterday regarding the treatment of the independent peer review process as part of the scope of the overall review of the seismic final, or as we decided, perhaps not final, seismic report. And I will leave a hard copy of it with Dr. Lamb, because I know he's got a six-hour flight today, and the in-flight magazine will be not nearly as interesting reading.
Yes,
as
indeed.
These 40
I look forward
pages.
To. I look forward to getting it.
I disagree.
And so I'll just take a quick, give the audience here a quick summary of just three moments from our data discovery and document requests. The first is a document from Ed Halpin and Richard Klimchak, who were here. Well, Mr. Klimchak was here last evening. Documenting, identifying a particular risk from the IPRP review. We have members who are experienced in processing and interpretation, but they could seek an independent review by others. The next category is probability of incurrence of this risk, and it's graded M as medium. The difficult of timely detection is graded as L or low, but the impact to scope and schedule is graded as H or high. The mitigation strategy identified by Mr. Halpin and Klimchak submitted for the IPRP review risk as follows. Mitigation. When presenting the results to the IPRP, PG&E will stress that advanced processing methods and interpretation techniques recommended by the industry and academia experts were used. Make process data available to the IP before the technical reports are provided for their review. Contingency. The IPRP's charter is to review results. PG&E could challenge any recommendations for additional processing or interpretation to be out of their scope. And then we'll just go on and hit with another highlight. Mr. Nushenko briefly in his opening remarks noted how the high-energy seismic studies permit was rejected by the California Coastal Commission. That was, again, that discussion took place last evening. But as our interrogatory makes clear, it wasn't ruled out of hand completely by the Coastal Commission. The Coastal Commission said, this permit you've submitted does not adequately meet our needs. That doesn't mean you couldn't come back with something written better or differently. However, this email, a day after the IPRP meeting, PG&E senior seismologist Stuart Nushenko emailed his colleagues. The meeting went well yesterday. No major surprises. The IPRP avoided making any demands we do high energy. Instead, they characterized it as the last tool in a toolbox to be used when we have exhausted all other options. So I think we'll be able to avoid the issue, as we'll consider linking the Hosgery and Shoreline as a worst-case scenario in the shack. In other words, PG&E never went back with a revised plan or permit for the high-energy thing. They ruled it out. Last tool in the toolkit didn't mean it was a closed issue. It means it was the last tool. We don't know if they got picking through the box far enough to have reached that tool. And the final bit I will read is an email from Legal Affairs Valerie Wynn to Mr. Znoshemko, Klimchak, and Abramson, and Mr. Krauss, and Mr. Strickland. Hey, the entire crowd that was here last night. And the subject was independent peer review port number 6. That's the one I mentioned. It's the last we've heard from anyone. After that report was issued, all public meetings ceased.
And we have that report, too.
Yeah. And the email says, I talked to CPUC staff members Gerbox Kalon, Don LaFrance, and Eric Green today about the IPERP process. They agreed that the IPERP should not do their own studies and that the scope of the IPERP's role is to review and comment on PG&E studies. In light of this conversation, I don't think we should risk rocking the boat by sending a letter or pressing the issue further at this time. If the IPERP starts to go too far in expanding the scope of its work, we can try and rein them in at that point. Then the rest of the sentence is redacted, and then it continues. I recommend we continue our current strategy of cooperating with the IPERP, monitor their activities, and follow up with the CPUC if we see some conflicts on the horizon. Mr. Krauss, who was here last evening, responded to the email back to her and to Eric Jacobson in Regulatory Affairs. Eric, when PG&E submits its final, in other words, as part of our discovery request, there was a large...
Oh, so it was PG&E who redacted. I wasn't sure whether it was redacted at the source.
No, PG&E redacted the email.
PG&E
was a Regulatory Affairs internal staff memo back to the seismic folks we saw here this evening. And the missing line there was redacted as part of the discovery request we were given.
Yeah, I wasn't sure who had redacted it. Thank you.
There were emails I could never see because only our attorney signed the non-disclosure agreement with them, so I couldn't see them. But this is these documents, as they are presented here, were officially accepted and taken into the record as a formal part of the case.
We've seen them, too. Thank you.
All right.
Any other questions?
Let the record reflect that Mr. Wiseman had provided me with a copy of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility's opening brief on a matter before the California Public Utility Commission, dated February 28, 2014. Thank you for that provision. As a matter of fact, as Dr. Butner indicated, the committee has also received this brief in one of the incoming communications.
So it's not only in our files, but it's in the public record.
Right. Now, in my first reading of the document, not from this hard copy you just provided me, Mr. Weissman, my first reading of the document is, in my business, there is usually only one set of facts, and there are many different sets of interpretation. I, for one, certainly welcome Mr. Giesman's interpretation of the facts. Without knowing the merits of Mr. Giesman, your capable legal counsel's observation and interpretation, without knowing the merits, I certainly feel this contributes to a useful public debate on the matters pending before the PUC. And thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Additional public comment? Again, please introduce yourself for the record.
Jane Swanson, spokesperson, San Luis Obispo, Mothers for Peace. Excuse my use of my teleprompter here. I have a three-part question. First, I want to confirm that, in fact, this committee was not a member of the Interagency and NGO Review Committee. Is that correct?
I think that's correct, yes.
We were not.
Okay,
no,
all right.
Not.
So part two of my comments and question is, your report claims that during the August 13, 2013 meeting of the review committee, the Independent Safety Committee was asked to make recommendations. But the notes of that meeting, in fact, indicate that the Independent Safety Committee was instead cited as making comments to Bechtel, PG&E's contractor. It appears to me, and you're going to correct me if I'm wrong, but it appears to me that the Independent Safety Committee is trying to give the impression that it has a more formal role in the water board process than it really does. And in reality, this body's comments to the water board have the same weight as those of any individual or citizen giving input. Is that correct?
Again, recognizing that we're a state chartered committee, that reports to agencies also to have us involved, because, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I would defer to counsel on this, but it would seem logical if you have state government requiring various different things that other state agencies have to work within the constraints of what, you know, the state law says they need to do. So in that case, we actually do have a formal role in performing the review.
Okay, if I understood you correctly, and maybe I did not, it's not that you were asked by the Water Board to do this report, it's that you decided, given your charter, that it was your responsibility to do this study and submit it to the Water Board.
It's not accurate.
Okay, sorry.
The first one, which was in August a year ago, was the result of a meeting that was perhaps in May of that year. I can look up when it was, but I think it was in May, that I went to, and they were sitting there, and Rochelle Becker, who's right here, you know, four meters from you, was a member. And at that meeting, perhaps the chair of that, it's not the Water Board, of course, it's a committee, reporting to the Water Board, an ad hoc committee. I was sitting there, and in a colloquy, it was clear we wanted to do that review, and so they asked us to. I mean, they really asked us to do that review. Now, it wasn't a formal request in writing that had any legal consequence, but they asked us to, and we said yes, and everybody understood that they wanted us to and that we wanted to. So it was a mutually want-want sort of thing. And I think it's fair to say Rochelle Becker is here. She can't speak for the committee, but she was there, and she can tell you what they probably thought, that our review had a different stature than if we were merely just a bunch of members of the public. I think that's a fair...
Right, no,
it's a fair observation. Mm-hmm. Is that fair? You know, and the reason for that is because we're appointed by state officials to do this sort of thing.
Now, okay? There's some truth to what Ms. Swanson is saying. My recollection is this committee, at the very beginning, without being asked to do the review, felt that we had the obligation under our charter. I mean, so there's some truth to what Ms. Swanson is saying.
Which is why we were attending those meetings.
If I could point out just one fact as well.
Okay.
And there was some misunderstanding, I'll say, or lack of understanding might be better. At the August 8th meeting, we tried to make it clear that we were asked to provide our comments on the draft Bechtel addendum before the public had the opportunity to comment, so that our comments could be part, possibly if they were taken, to be part of the addendum when it was released for public comment.
That's the 24th. That's the 2014 round. I was talking about the earlier one a year ago.
Oh, that one.
But at the very beginning, I do not recall the committee was asked to participate in the Water Resource Board was doing.
No, we weren't.
But, we were not.
But we took it upon ourselves to go. I went between Dr. Peterson and myself. I went to some and he went to some. And we went on our own. Nobody asked us to because it was interesting to us. And having been there, what arose was this idea that, yeah, it'd be a great idea if you guys would do it. And we said, yeah, great idea, we will do it. So that's why we did it.
In fact, I
draw one of the words that I said. I said the committee's comments had no more weight than an individual. Mm-hmm. I should not have used that word. I should have said no more, not a different standing than the input
we
of anybody
We have no
else.
Authority of any sort.
An insult was not intended, Dr. Budnitz. I shouldn't have used that word.
Because we took it, I'll just say, I at least took that. It's impossible that what you said could have been taken this way as an insult. It couldn't be. It's not.
Okay. Anyway, I regret the use of the word weight and substitute standing. Okay.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, third part of my comment. I want to add to Linda Seeley's motherly advice that she offered yesterday. She told me about it on the phone. I had to leave before that, but it sounded pretty interesting and right on from the Mothers for Peace viewpoint. And I'd like to add to that and say that the version of this committee's report that I saw, which I realize has been amended or changed.
Well,
I realize
no, the first or the second report? Because
second.
We
you mean this one?
The review of the addendum, Bechtel addendum report.
Go ahead.
Correct. Most recent one, as I saw it, and recognizing
I can't
And recognizing that you have made changes between yesterday and today without knowing what they are, nonetheless, my statement is that that report did definitely appear biased, and it appeared to draw unsubstantiated conclusions, some of which were addressed by Bill Powers yesterday. If I were in a position to dictate, which I am not, if I were the queen of the universe, I would suggest this committee should start over from scratch on this report, because the version of your report that I read gives the appearance, this is not an accusation, but it gives the appearance of an attempt to lobby on behalf of PG&E's effort to gain an exemption to the state's marine protection policy. That is the way it looks to my eyes. Mm-hmm. And I know you will not agree with it, but I appreciate the opportunity to state how it looks to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will be coming back to this later on the agenda, but I think that it is very important to recognize that in our review, what the Friends of the Earth review and critique of the Bechtel report was focused on was various different ways that you could design cooling towers to reduce their cost and make them more affordable. And we concurred that some of these types of changes would be unlikely to have substantive safety impact, such as moving the towers to higher elevation, such as making the towers a bit smaller to reduce their capital cost at the expense of a somewhat larger D-rate on the power output of the plant. We also found that there were other things, you know, such as the choice of the specific type of cooling tower that we didn't find would obviously cause safety impacts. But the two specific issues that we've identified, which is attempting to have a 6-year construction period of these plants on the south side of the plant, which would have a substantive impact on the operation of the plant, as well as to use salt water with the potential to greatly increase the quantity. The changes did decrease safety, required a substantial process of very careful review, which our committee was followed quite closely. And that was primarily because of the large impacts on the capability to maintain access to the plant and the need to confirm that under emergency conditions, which you don't practice routinely, that the impact would be acceptable. The proposed changes that would involve a large-scale construction project on the south side of the plant would at a minimum require very careful review and would have some negative impact for sure. The question is the magnitude of that impact and whether it's acceptable compared to the alternative placing, you know, cooling towers on the north side of the plant.
And whether it could be mitigated.
And what we'll say today, I think, is that we just don't know on those two specific design options the magnitude of the safety impact and whether one would consider it to be acceptable or not. But I think that it's difficult to reach a conclusion that there's some ulterior motive to our concern about these two particular issues, because we've said that there's several other things that could make these designs more affordable that would be perfectly fine. So at any rate, if it does give that appearance, then perhaps we can try to word things better. But in the end, I think it's necessary for us to use our best judgment.
On the other hand, based on what we learned yesterday at the public meeting, we have overnight, we meaning Furman Wardell, has drafted some changes that we think address those concerns and make sure that this misreading, which you alluded to, has been addressed. We think we've addressed that, and and if we haven't, well, we'll see.
And then the one other thing is that over the last couple of days, because we realize that these are important issues not to be left hanging, I think that we've certainly committed ourselves to study these specific questions in much greater detail so that there can be a better factual basis for understanding what impacts might be and to try to do it as quickly as we can so that it would not end up impacting the decision-making process that needs to go on in parallel with respect to closed cooling.
But some of the stuff we need to know nobody knows because the detail hasn't been developed. And that's going to be a problem.
And Dr. Budnitz and the chairman gave me a perfect lead in here. I am going to distribute some copies that we just had made this morning to the members of the committee. Also give Gary a copy for PG&E, and I will make some available in the back of the room, which is a revised draft of our October 15 draft. So if I can...
And this was developed overnight by Furman Wardell, based on who's our consultant, based on our discussion yesterday.
Now, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Butness. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And Dr. Butness, after listening to Ms. Swanson on her comments about the committee report, came across to her and her organization as being unwittingly contributing to the licensee's clients of Federal Clean Water Act.
I would fight writing that into this report with all my strength.
May I ask why?
No, let me say, because a disclaimer like that is gratuitous and unnecessary. It goes without saying.
Wait, it goes without saying that this committee...
It goes without saying that that's our position. To put it in here would insult me and my intelligence, and I will vote against it. Now, if you two vote, you'll all vote me 2-1. But I'm not going to vote for that. I resist it with every bone in my body.
May I listen to more of your rationale?
Yes, we don't need to have a disclaimer like that in anything we write. Our charter tells the world of our independence, and our writing is either read as independent or not, depending on the reader. It's their problem, not ours, although we try to do what we do. And I don't think a disclaimer like that can accomplish anything except just insult. What I mean by that is, those that want to misread it will misread it. Those that don't won't. And the disclaimer won't affect either. But because doing that calls attention to our concern, you'd ask why we wouldn't put that in every single thing we ever wrote. And I don't want to put it anywhere. I really feel that deeply.
Now, maybe without a disclaimer.
And we haven't talked about this before.
Right,
I love you.
Right. Now, perhaps with Dr. Bunner's strong observation, perhaps the committee can put in a statement in there. The intent of the review of the committee is strictly obligated by our charter.
Okay. Oh, well, that's in here, I think.
Is it in there?
I think at this point we're actually broaching on discussion that we'll hold later on.
Thank you.
I think that we do want, in part because we'd like to leave some time for people who would like a chance to scan through the changes that are indicated in the marked version of this draft.
But geez, we don't need
We should move and complete the public comment and then move on to presentations by PG&E. At which point we will return to the question related to this report. So continuing with public comment.
Yeah, this is Gene Nelson, San Luis Obispo. First of all, I've emailed to the committee a formal statement regarding my perspective that Diablo Canyon isn't broken, so don't actually make recommendations to fix it in this case.
And that email will go into our record.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, it will go into your record.
It becomes a public document.
Mr. Rathi, has that already been, have you received that?
I have not had a chance to look at my email.
All right, okay, great. But I just want to say, I'm going to extract a couple of brief paragraphs from this, and that is that the State Water Resources Control Board proposal will force PG&E to place huge quantities of high flow velocity, high conductivity salt and brackish water above the 85-foot level. This is a disaster waiting to happen that wouldn't require an earthquake to unleash this dangerous high conductivity water. In summary, the State Water Resources Control Board plan could create a potential man-made saltwater tsunami at Diablo Canyon, seriously compromising long-term plant safety. And therefore, I'm recommending that the committee oppose this proposal from the State Water Resources Control Board. And we should be thinking about the safety of the public as well as the safety of the plant. Safety of the public, I don't want to see people like my 85-year-old mother and my 90-year-old stepfather dying because of increased amounts of pollution in the air because we have to burn fossil fuel instead of clean, safe nuclear. So thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to listen.
Thank you.
Additional comment from the public?
Can't resist. Sherry Lewis, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. A disclaimer means nothing to me. I simply wouldn't believe a disclaimer. So save your breath. As far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Additional
you go for
comment.
Dr. Butness.
No, I just do what I do.
Rochelle Becker, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. I just wanted to clarify, seeing as my name got brought up a couple of times earlier. I do sit on the committee. We did appreciate very much having the Safety Committee weigh in. I think the Safety Committee was actually formed for just this type of thing. They didn't include the Safety Committee when we first started the process because it was about technology. What technology is even feasible? What couldn't even possibly be done? And then we went into phase two, which we started talking about money. And what decisions would we make? What would this cost? And the original concern when we licensed Diablo Canyon and put it in the rate base was that they would not do certain things or they would withhold certain things during refueling outages because they were being paid per kilowatt hour. So this is exactly the type of thing that the committee was set up to do. Let us know if there's safety concerns. Bechtel said that there wouldn't be any license amendment requests needed to be filed for this project, no matter whose project it was, Friends of the Earth or Bechtel's project. No license amendment request would be needed. I think the Safety Committee has looked at that carefully and helped us out by saying, oh, we have a little difference of opinion here. So no decisions have been made. The Water Board's committee is a little bit perplexed right now about what we're supposed to do as well, but we'll learn more on the 18th, and I thank you for writing the letter in support of the webcast. I talked to PG&E, who said that they would support in a letter or a phone call supporting the webcast. They did say they would offer to pay for it, which I had to chuckle at because it is the ratepayers, of course, that will end up paying for it. But anyway, thank you for your participation.
Thank you.
Just to ask a question. A few minutes ago, I characterized the interaction between us and your committee. And I wondered whether that was accurate. My characterization was, we went on our own. You didn't invite us. Your committee didn't invite us. But when we came, the first meeting I went to, the chairman came up and said, "Boy, we're glad you're here." Mm-hmm. And then we went each time. Mm-hmm. And when that issue came up of asking us, it wasn't a formal written request, but it sort of says, will you do it? And we said, yes, we would, and everybody was happy.
It was discussed at the committee. I can tell you that the committee's minutes do not always reflect everything discussed, but it was discussed by the committee.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Additional public comment?
This isn't
okay.
Yeah, I'm Pete Kelly. President of the Avila Beach Community Service District. First thing I want to say after listening to the comments, I'm really glad there wasn't high power seismic testing. We had the best Dungeness season ever. Time I was here, I was shocked to find out that the life of a dry cask was recommended at 15 years, but sometimes they're extending them to 20. Now, how much does it cost to change out a dry cask? And I won't ask the cost for the 200,000 years that will have to be done. I will assume that something will be done with the waste before then. And who's going to pay for it? I suggest PG&E, out of their stockholder funds, put in an escrow account to pay for the changing out of dry casks for the next 100 years. Now, since basically, I've been around here ever since the beginning of the plant. I know hundreds of people that have worked there. But it was licensed till 2024. PG&E produces energy. This is over. Let's move on. Thank you.
Okay, maybe Bob will take the 64.
I'll try to answer your first inquiry. The efficiency of the cooling system, the one-through cooling system at the plant, does depend on the temperature at the intake. It's slightly more efficient when the water is colder in the winter, and slightly less efficient, this is just every year, when the water is warmer in the summer, and this summer is warmer than normal, so it's slightly less efficient. It's not a very large effect, but it is certainly a small effect, and I don't remember the numbers, but they're easily, we could find them for you if you really want to know the details. It's a small but certainly a correct observation that the plant is slightly less efficient, which means that they produce slightly less electricity and slightly more waste heat because of the thermal, it's really the thermodynamic properties of the heat exchanger cycle. Okay.
And I can briefly touch on the question related to the longevity and cost of the dry cast storage and disposal cost. The first is that the dry casks are licensed for 20 years, but most analyses suggest that they could function for 100 years or more, although we're going to go back and review that in greater detail because the coastal environment is clearly more challenging to materials than the inland environment where most of the dry cast storage is. With regard to the cost of the storage, the prolonged storage as well as disposal, the PG&E has a contract with the Department of Energy that legally obligates the Department of Energy. First of all, the courts have decided to pay for the costs of the storage because the government is now in partial default of the contracts by not beginning to accept the waste when it had was obligated to. And also, the federal government has the full obligation to pay all costs associated with the disposal of the fuel in consideration of the fact that PG&E had paid a fee into the Nuclear Waste Fund earlier. That's how the contracts are structured. Of course, the bigger problem is that the entire U.S. waste program has collapsed and it's not functioning. There's not actually a big difference between ratepayers and taxpayers. And so the fact that the taxpayers will
and committed to get a long-term waste depository license and operation.
I just want to address the license question. The NRC gave a license to not just here, but around the country. There are a couple dozen of these installations already, and more coming, for the long-term storage independent spent fuel installations. They gave 20-year license. But that 20-year license didn't mean by any means that that was the end of the things would go to pot after that. And my analogy, which I once heard give somebody else, but it's not a bad one. I'm going to give it to you. When I was 16, I got a driver's license, and it was good for 5 years. Okay, that didn't mean that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where I lived at the time, thought that I couldn't drive at 21. It only meant I had to come back and get it again with another test. And by the way, in Massachusetts, you had to take another test all the time. I can't move to California. I only take the test every 10th year. And in the in-between ones, you don't have to take the test. You just send it in. They give it to you. Well, I just got a new one, and I'm in my 70s, and it's for 5 years. Well, you know, when I'm in my 80s, are they going to give me another 5 years, or does it ever get shorter? Because I know some people in their 80s that can't drive.
But still do.
No, don't laugh. I had a next-door neighbor who was 96 and went in, and he got a 5-year driver's license renewal. And he, a year later, gave it up voluntarily. But the state of California gave him a 5-year license. It tells you that the duration of the license they give you and the duration of how long this thing will remain safe, and that's not a bad metaphor, isn't the same. The NRC has appropriately said that at the end of the 20 years, not at the end, 2 or 3 years to go, at every one of these, they're going to do a detailed evaluation to assure that they can renew the license for another 20 years, or maybe 10, or maybe longer. They haven't said, because the first ones are just starting. But until the time runs on, we're not going to know whether that 100-year projection of the engineering community is going to be correct until probably in 80 or 90 years. You'll see. Mm-hmm. Maybe at 80 years, people will conclude, you know, there hasn't been any degradation at all. It's probably good for another 50. But because these are new, there's never been anything like it anywhere before, there's no way to know how long they will actually last before degradation sets in. And so I'm very pleased that the NRC was prudent in giving them a license of only 20 years, which is way shorter than anybody thinks, but is nevertheless prudent. In the same sense that at 16 they only gave me a driver's license for 5 years, nobody thought I was going to go to pot at 21, but that's what they did.
But I am sympathetic to public opinion here that the waste inside that cast will last hundreds of thousands of years.
Right. Will remain hazardous.
Right,
will
remain hazardous, right? Therefore, a 20-year license within that context need to be examined again and again.
Correct.
Let's agree.
Additional public comment. Please step to the podium and introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Simone Malboff from Los Osos, and I'm here to just enlighten you, maybe. I don't know, I was enlightened, but you may not be, about some relatively new revelations on how groundwater supplies in the San Joaquin Valley affect seismic activity in California. This information was taken from the summer 2014 issue of the Tahoe Quarterly publication. And the article was written by David A. Bunker. Water pumping in California's Central Valley has actually caused the Sierra Nevada mountains and the California coastal mountain ranges to rise and has put new stresses on the state's earthquake faults. The Earth's crust is surprisingly elastic, the report says, and the heavy load of winter snowpack actually subtly depresses the Sierra Nevadas while subtly swelling the Central Valley floor during snowmelt in the spring. Over the last 150 years, as the equivalent of the entire volume of Lake Tahoe has been sucked from the ground in the Central Valley without replenishment, the Central Valley has permanently dropped, while the mountains have inched higher, according to this study. Meanwhile, California landowners engage in a drilling frenzy in the Central Valley to punch new wells and increase the depth of their existing wells in groundwater grabs that one landowner calls a race to the bottom, unquote. So who would have thought, at least I didn't, or suspected, that emptying the aquifers of the Central Valley and this drought, combined with this drought, could have possibly affected our mountains so dramatically and our earthquake faults. For those of us living on or around 13 earthquake faults, not only is this startling news, but it also reminds us of how the earth and its land, its mountains, fresh water, and oceans are all interconnected, probably in ways even our best geological experts and other scientists are just beginning to learn. As the residents who experienced an earthquake magnitude of 6.0 on August 24th of this year in Napa will attest to, human beings are not really capable of predicting when an earthquake will occur along known or unknown fault lines, nor with what magnitude they might occur. At least it is, at best, it is an educated guess. And the same is true of tsunamis. We can't really predict. Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima were all results of natural disasters, human error, and design flaws. Natural disasters and human errors are not under our control. We are powerless to stop those, but we can mitigate their destruction by consciously choosing to replace archaic and dangerous technology with safer, more sustainable sources of power that supports life on the earth and does not threaten it. Let us become leaders of solar, wind, and wave technology and start creating a world that is free of harmful effects of man-made carbon and man-made radiation. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Additional public comment? Thank you. At this point, it's time for us to move on to PG&E presentations. I will turn things over to Kerry Harbor. He's Director for Compliance, Alliance, and Risk at Diablo Canyon Power Plant.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So our prepared presentations today, the first one that we have is on the topic of digital control systems. And presenting this topic is our Supervisor of Digital System Engineering, Brian Maul. And Brian has greater than 20 years of experience and has a Bachelor of Science in Electronic Engineering and has a number of experiences in the areas of instrumenting.
Love living here. Okay. So, as Kerry mentioned, I'm the Digital Systems Engineering Supervisor. And today I just want to provide an overview of the digital control systems. And also, next slide. We'll also talk about the performance history, recent upgrades, and future upgrades. So first of all, what does digital mean? We hear that term used a lot. And why does it matter? So the simple answer, control functions have moved from electromechanical control to computer control. much like the cars that we all drive now. It matters because in the end, these control systems have become more reliable. I think we can all agree our cars have become more reliable, ultimately providing a safer operating plant. So I'm going to talk about three control systems. These are there are primary control systems at Diablo Canyon, one being the turbine control system. Next is our feedwater control system. And last, our process control system. And as you can see, these were installed in the past decade and one quite recently.
What, there's also reactor control and protection.
That's protection. That's not control.
Oh, protection. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's also digital at this point?
Yes. Part of that is digital. Yes.
And is it covered in the presentation?
No, it's not. I'll talk about it at the end because we are going to be upgrading that in the near future.
Okay.
Thank you. So the first one I want to talk about is our turbine control system. Technically, digital electrohydraulic control. We just shortened that to turbine control. It regulates the governor valve position, which in turn controls the steam flow for all modes of turbine operation. So essentially, this system controls the turbine generator during plant startup, normal operations, and plant shutdown.
The turbine control actually has been digital for a long time. The current system dates to 2004, but it was converted to digital control earlier than that.
That
correct?
Is correct. So it's a newer control system. Thank you. And I'll touch on that later. So the next one I'll talk about is our feedwater control system. So it automatically maintains our steam generator water level. That's the first heat exchanger in the plant. During steady state operations, it restores and maintains the water level within safe levels during normal unit transients. Essentially, the newer controls, these digital controls, have reduced or eliminated operator interaction, which is very important, during system transients. And this has prevented unnecessary plant trips, which we try and avoid, and also simplifying its operation. So lastly, the process control system. And this is the most recent upgrade. This system converts physical plant parameters to component or system degradation. And generally, those are recorded and kept for approximately 10 years. Next. So on the next slide, this is a screenshot of our turbine control display. I know it's kind of hard to read, but I'll just point out a couple of things. You can just see the big picture. Over here on the left, if you can see my laser pointer, that's essentially that's a dial, kind of like what we used to see in our cars. If you have an old car, it might still look like that. But that's basically showing the shaft speed, so normally at 1,800 RPM. And over here on the right, that's actually providing a dial indication of the megawatt output. And if you'll notice, there's actually a little digital display down below that gives a more exact number. And some might want to ask, how do we come up with this display? This actually is a recreation of the Westinghouse display that it replaced. So essentially, that we tried to reduce the amount of stress on the operator when we changed systems about a decade ago. And
I mean, it was just familiarity.
Exactly. Yeah. Didn't want to upset the apple cart. That was something that they were familiar with, and it works for them. So you also note that down here there's says load target, and there's actually a set point. Actually, on this screen is actually showing that they're going to be, ramping the unit at some point, or at least they're prepping to do that. And so they're going to punch that number in and a rate, and when they're ready to go, they'll hit. Right now it's on hold, and when they're ready to go, they're ready to go and hit the button. Okay, next slide. So this one, fortunately, it's a little brighter. This is our feed water control display. Again, a snapshot or a screenshot. And keep in mind, these screens are touch screens, so they don't have to move a mouse. This is very easy to control. This is actually just showing, in the green bars actually are showing the steam generator level. This allows the operator to move things up and down all at once or independently. And technically, this is the feed water regulating valve control display. And as I mentioned before, maintains the steam generator water level. And as we can reach, there's actually buttons down here that they can reach other screens to look at the other valves that they need to control. Next screen. So to get a better picture on where these are located, this is actually in the control room, and you can see the feed water control screen that's located here, and right next door is the turbine control, and very handy for the operators to operate. Next. So benefits and features dedicated on that particular type of module. So that reduces our impact on the maintenance organization.
So do they share a lot of commonality on the software platform too? I bet they do. Obviously they have to have specifics, but
yeah, they actually you're getting down to the flexibility part, and that they are very flexible in how they are programmed, so to speak, to operate. They are logic controllers. They aren't like your computer that may be sitting on your desk or at home. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I understood.
Okay. So obviously reliability is a key feature of these systems. Ease of redundancy. And what I mean by ease of redundancy, these are inherently redundant. So the design engineers didn't have to spend time and come up with a complex way of making the system redundant. The system is inherently redundant by the manufacturer. He provides that. They provide that redundancy. Less maintenance is required. These are very reliable units. Hence we don't have to replace components very often. It's very rare, in fact. Flexibility, you mentioned, we use these modules in different systems. They're programmed accordingly for that particular purpose. And unlike in previous systems, zero moving parts. So
Brian, are these considered safety-related control systems, or?
Yes, at least the process control system, yes. Yeah.
I just want to tell you an anecdote about a difference.
Sure.
You said less maintenance is required, and you don't have to replace things very often because of their high reliability and so on.
Yes.
And that means you don't have to have a whole warehouse full of spare parts, although you have to have adequate.
Yes, we always have spare parts.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell a story for the public.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
The first time I ever went to a plant that the Soviet nuclear people had designed was in Russia. And the control room was about the size of this room. By the way, the control rooms at your plant are about the size of this room for two units.
Yeah.
And everything was vacuum tubes. And in answer to the question, you'll know the question I asked when they showed the answer. You go through that door and there was a big room the same size but full of racks just of vacuum tubes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because those vacuum tubes had to be replaced more or less. They might last a month or two. And every tube in that plant had to be replaced all that time. And in the meantime, they were drifting all over the place because tubes drift, mm-hmm. which meant they spent most of their time calibrating instruments and making sure they weren't drifting.
Yeah.
And then in answer to the next question, there was a dedicated factory somewhere east of Moscow that just made tubes for the nuclear plants, of whom they had 50, altogether, because they wanted to make sure that they didn't have to rely on some supply chain that wasn't unreliable. So the atomic energy people had their own plant just making tubes for those plants. And then one day they learned about transistors. Okay? And in 3 years they changed it all out. as you imagine. Not what we have fancy, but at least it was better. And all of a sudden, they got rid of that great big room full of tubes. Well, we've come a long way from that.
They can be replaced online, and so that maintains our uninterrupted control. Built-in online diagnostics, so we don't have to hook up any additional hardware or software, much the same as your car mechanic. A lot of online diagnostics in our vehicles today.
Can you explain how you replace something online? Is there an automatic switch over to the backup and then you replace the other one?
Sure, I can explain. Sure.
Is that
so
what it is?
Essentially, there are three modules that are operating in parallel at any given time.
Three.
So
okay.
They're processing the same signal. And if, let's say, the system detects a fault on one of its modules. So the other two are already running. Okay. So that allows us to go in and insert a replacement module.
And they're still functioning.
And pull the other one out.
And I suppose if you only had double redundancy, you'd be worried about that. But with the triple, you still have two.
That's correct. That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, very very similar to our hot swap hard drives you might
sure.
see in a server farm.
Right.
Very similar.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is the double redundancy something that is an actual regulation that you have to have that, so you put in triple so you can make the replacement?
No, the triple redundancy is actually inherent in the manufacturer's design. And it's a great lead into my last point. These systems were utilized, you know, this platform per se, it was utilized already in the petroleum and chemical industries, you know, in highly critical and safety-related applications, and so we stole them. So, next slide. So performance. So none of these aforementioned digital control systems ever caused a unit trip, lost their ability to perform a safety function, nor have they caused an unplanned change in reactor power. So as a result, operators have of the overall system, they can depend upon it and safely and reliably under all conditions. I want to point out, not only have they not caused a issue at Diablo Canyon, but across all their installations, this particular platform, a plant has never gone down with
That's
these.
Great.
So, pretty good record. So recent upgrades, I mentioned before, the process control system recently installed in 2012, the auxiliary control system, which was recently installed in 06, which is not part of our process control, not part of the plant control, but that was replaced recently. Next. Future upgrades. Condensate polisher. So That is actually part of our secondary system. That basically keeps our chemistry in line in the secondary. And the reactor protection system, you mentioned, you asked about that earlier. That's not a control system, but that is slated for replacement here in the upcoming years. And part of that actually was replaced about 20 years ago and was turned digital. And so it's time again to replace it with yet another digital system.
If I remember, you're
where things are going, especially if another plant is installing a system or desires to install a system like ours, and it's actually a very good way of seeing problems that we may not foresee, but somebody else has experienced first. So it's good from an operating experience standpoint.
Great.
I'd like to add one other thing to this, being on the user side of it. As a control room supervisor, I was, you know, in the control room before we had the digital systems like we had today. So the controls are, you know, astronomically better in terms of precision. But the other thing that didn't come out so much here that I wanted to bring forward was that there is an extreme element of this that's related to human performance. So, you know, you, imagine you have your car, you get ready to start your car, you got a key, you turn your car on, it starts up. And if you wanted that to happen, you go, oh, that's great. Yeah, I did. But if for some reason you go, oh, wait, you know what? I didn't want to start the car yet. You turn it off, right? No harm, no foul. Now, in a nuclear plant, of course, you don't really want that to happen. So, you know, in these systems, they actually have human factors so that before you get ready to initiate that, what will happen is it'll ask you, hey, do you really want to do this? It'll pop up and make sure that there's confirmation so you have your chance to say, wait, I don't want to do that before you actually start your car. So you have the ability, and those are built into a number of the control elements that you saw here that Brian presented. So it's been really, really good. It's helped us to reduce errors as well, and it's all part of attacking human performance without, you know, having to just rely specifically on the operator.
And also, before you leave the podium, would you share with us the extent of your effort here? The totality of it. How many people had been involved?
Oh, in my group?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I have seven folks in my group, six permanent employees and one contractor. And essentially, you know, our job function is to maintain, not from a maintenance standpoint, we don't actually change out the equipment. That maintenance personnel take care of that. But we manage the data side and any planning with regards to replacement and keeping the systems operational.
So that is a significant effort.
It keeps us very, very busy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
Good for you. Thank you.
Good for you. Can you tell us anything that, is there anything particularly work overload during outages for you? Is there things that you only can do during outages?
Great question. Actually, it's the opposite.
I wouldn't have thought that there was as much because unlike maintaining equipment in a radioactive area that you can't get to,
right.
It's just the opposite. Well,
generally it's the opposite. You know, the process control system is obviously an exception.
Yeah, but a lot of stuff, it's not doing anything during the outage.
Right. So a lot of our systems, we you know, there's very much a desire to have those systems in tip-top condition and no touch during the outage because they rely upon them immensely. And so most of our work is done offline.
But other people know that knocks out all computer stuff. Isn't that a possibility? And if so, what happens then? That's one question. The second question is if a person needs to take over and counteract the computer, can they? I'm a Luddite, I guess.
Thank you. We'll take those additional public comment or question. Is there an answer?
Brian, you want to try to?
Brian, if you might, possibility to knock out, so I would assume EMP, and then also.
Sure. So from a control system standpoint, that's really not an issue. You know, those systems are really just for control. The reactor protection system, which you brought up, you know, that is designed, you know, to protect the reactor in case of any event. So it'll automatically, you know, safely shut down the plant. So, there was another question.
When you said it's not an issue, say that one more sentence.
Sure. So if
you made a distinction between the control system, just make that distinction.
Okay. So the control system that we were talking about today, so you know, there are several control systems. So that's really controlling the operation of the plant. That's a separate system than a system that's actually designed to safely shut down the plant. Okay. It's a protection system. You don't want to mix apples and oranges. You don't want to mix the control and protection.
I know the answer to this, but I mean they're just completely separate.
Sorry,
they're just completely separate.
Yes,
and they don't interact.
That's correct.
So that if some bad person wanted to do something over here, it cannot. Oh, it's not electrically or somehow connected to the other.
Yeah, the control and the protection, they're not connected.
And that's by design.
That's correct.
I know it.
And there was a second part? to the.
There was also something about if the computer is not doing what you want it to, can you somehow bypass it? I think was that
just take control.
Yeah.
Can a human being?
Yeah.
I think basically this when it comes to the reactor protection functions. The truth is that the human can bypass on scram.
Absolutely.
In other words, because de-energizing the control rod system and generating a scram to shut the reactor down, you can do it manually. And it's all of these things that provide electrical power to the electromagnetic switches.
It's okay.
There's many different places where you can interrupt that flow of power and therefore cause a scram. So you can do it manually, or the reactor protection system can do it automatically as well.
Right. If it lost power, it would automatically shut down.
I think that that's not only built into your design, but that is actually required by NRC regulation that be like that.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. I was sure of that.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, without that possibility of a manual intervention, if you needed it, we wouldn't feel as comfortable with the safety of the plant as we need to be.
Talking to you a little bit about the strategic plan that we have in place right now, specifically focused on accreditation renewal for the maintenance and technical training programs. Before I get into that, I do want to take a quick minute and say that I honestly am proud to work at Diablo Canyon. It's a very good place to work. I understand that with that employment, there comes an extra responsibility of safe operation of the plant. And I can stand here and tell you today with confidence that there's a motivated workforce out there that's specifically focused on doing just that on a daily basis.
Sure.
It's also very clear that Is that better? Okay, thanks. It's also very clear that a strong training program directly supports the safe operation of the plant, and we're fully committed to maintaining that. That's what this plan is geared towards doing. I also want to mention that I, like many of the other individuals that work at Diablo, like to stay engaged in the local community, and what I enjoy doing is acting as a docent to lead hikes out the Petra Coast Trail out to the lighthouse. So if you have not done that yet, I highly encourage you to get out there and tour that lighthouse. It's absolutely beautiful. It's built in 1890. It's a Victorian, completely remodeled lighthouse. It's absolutely beautiful. Every Wednesday and Saturday morning. Okay, the hike starts right out here at the main gate to Diablo Canyon, so it's very easy to find. Okay, objectives of what I would like to go over today are fourfold. First, I want to describe some of the basic elements of the plan so you understand that. Provide a time frame for completion of that plan. We're going to highlight some of the actions that we have already completed to date and then describe the results that we've achieved and how we're going to monitor this as we go forward. Okay, a little background on this whole effort is, as you well know, training programs at a nuclear power plant are required to be accredited, and they are on a 4-year accreditation cycle. The ops training programs are separate typically from the maintenance and technical training programs, and they're offset by a 2-year cycle there as well. So if you look at that timeline there, you can see that the ops training programs were recently renewed in January of this year, and the maintenance and technical training programs will be up for renewal in March of 2016. So it's about a 2-year spread right there. In the middle is our accreditation team visit. So that's a week-long trip by the accreditation visit team members who come out and evaluate the training programs and then provide that information to the board members who ultimately weigh in on the renewal or not. Okay, so that's what basically prompted this whole thing. So that kind of started it. And the origin of the plan, as I recall, or as I just mentioned, the ops training programs were recently renewed in January of this year. So on the plane flight back from that visit, the leadership team that represented Diablo at that accrediting board conducted a critique of their performance and how that whole process went with the intention of trying to identify some lessons learned and what can we do to improve it at the process as we go forward. It was also captured as a self-assessment in our process at Diablo. That's one of the tools that we use to continually improve. And so out of that critique, they came up with a handful of recommendations, and you can see those there. The first one was, let's put together a plan specifically to help us work through these, wait until the last minute, clearly. And no, that's okay. That's good. Okay, so that was kind of the big picture, what came out of, or how this plan came about, or the need for it. It came from the critique on the flight back from the accreditation visit, or I'm sorry, the board visit. So what does this plan consist of? Well, basically, it starts off with a challenge statement. So what are we trying to do? Where should we focus our efforts? And then it rolls into specific actions for different groups. First section within the action framework has to do with communication. So clearly there's going to be a significant communication effort involved with this that's focusing on how do we ensure that people who are going to be involved in the board visit understand what that looks like and what to expect. It also is going back and providing some refresher training on the systematic approach to training, so the backbone of how we conduct training at the power plant. And then the last thing is just what kind of routine communications do we want to make to plant personnel to keep them aware of this ongoing effort. The next section has to do with the training staff actions, or what kind of actions is the training department going to be responsible for. There's also a section in there on the functional organizational actions, or the departments in the plant. What actions do they need to take to put this plan in place? Next slide. And then the last two components of the plan were we took what we believed to be important from a communication standpoint, put that into a plan, and included that in this overall plan. And the last piece is really important. We took a look at the power history events over the last 4 years, or the accreditation cycle, and evaluated each one of those against training, and was their training provided as a result of that issue, and if so, what kind of benefit did that bring to the station. That analysis gets updated on an ongoing basis, and it's also something that's reviewed at each one of the training oversight committee meetings. Training oversight, or TOC, is the top tier of our three-tiered structure of training committees that we have at the station. The TOC is comprised of senior leadership, and they're responsible for overviewing all of the training programs at the plant.
Just briefly, you want to explain to the public what the strategic communication plan is? Who's communicating with whom? I mean, I understand it, but just explain that.
That's largely how are we going to communicate and to whom and by when. So we work with the communication staff at Diablo, and we send out communications through eConnect. It's an email communication on almost a weekly or biweekly basis. There are communication efforts that happen within the training committees themselves. There are communication efforts that happen within the other, the training advisory committee and the training oversight committee. And then also it's communicating. Well, the initial communication effort was that kickoff meeting that we had, where we brought in all of the committee chairmen and had them sit down, and we started it off with a mock board presentation using a lot of the people that had just come back from the board. So it's a kind of an across-the-board plan. Does that help?
Yes. Don't
okay.
Yeah, no, it was good. Yeah.
Okay, next page. Okay, so in more detail, what actions were put in this plan specifically for the training department? Well, the first one is to benchmark the accreditation renewal process in general, and you're familiar with the benefits of benchmarking, right? We stands for Accreditation Self-Evaluation Report, and it's basically a health report of the training programs that we put together and give to the evaluation team when they come on site. So that's the first big effort. The second one then is to make sure we're fully prepared for the accreditation team visit. So there's a lot of scheduling and work that takes place before the team ever shows up on site. We need to make sure we've got plenty of training opportunities available for them to observe. Interviews are set up. There's a huge scheduling effort that happens. And then the last piece of it is once those two things are done, the last step is the accrediting board visit. So there's focus on what the preparations need to be for that piece as well. Yes?
Could you explain briefly who the accrediting board people are? For example, would someone like you possibly be on an accrediting board for another plan?
I would like to, but no, I would not be.
No, not just you personally, but people like you wouldn't be.
That's correct. Typically, the board members...
Conflict.
Say again?
Because of the sort of a conflict, okay.
It would be that, but at the same time, it's individuals that have experience or work history that goes beyond where I'm at right now. So, for example, it could be comprised of people like ex-NRC inspectors, senior executives from the university system.
Or somebody in from a plant that might be retired, so they don't have...
Correct. Or, for example, an executive from the airline industry.
Okay.
So it's outside of nuclear power as well. It's not just limited to the industry itself. There's five board members. Okay.
And how long do they take when they're here?
Well, the board members don't come out here. The accrediting team comes out here. That's a representative group from the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. They do the evaluation. They provide all of their insight as an attachment to our ACER. Okay, so then that ultimately is the complete total picture of the program health. That goes to the board members who are back in Atlanta.
Thank you.
Completely separate from the National Academy for Nuclear Training.
So the board is someplace else, and they're reviewing all this information that's developed by a team that reports to them.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, so we talked about the training staff actions. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't get through that. So the next piece is we're going to periodically brief the Training Oversight Committee on industry findings to keep them engaged. We are going to develop a STARS peer review process. Okay, STARS is an acronym that stands for Strategic Teaming and Resource Sharing. So Diablo Canyon is involved with several other power plants to act as an organization where we can benefit from that relationship with each other through sharing of resources, for example. So in this case here, we're able to use their expertise also in approaching some of these activities. And then the last thing, again, for training staff actions is to participate in industry self-assessments, accreditation team visits, and mock boards. So the whole idea there is to, again, make sure that we're not isolated out here on the West Coast. We're involved in this same process at other power plants to help bring about better understanding of what good looks like. Okay, then we move on to the functional organization actions. And again, this is the departments within the plant. What's their role in this plan? And the first thing that's on the list there is that training health report. It's largely discussion about how we're meeting certain guidelines that are required for training programs, but at the same time, it's full of a lot of examples to support those write-ups. And that's one of the places those examples come from. The next action was to rejuvenate the performance improvement roll-up process. Performance improvement roll-up is a process at the plant that's carried out by each department, and basically what they do is they periodically get together, look at the corrective action program documents, notifications, they look at observations, and they try to look for low-level trends of issues that we want to address right now before they become a big issue. Once they do that, then they would request a performance analysis request by the training department. So they say, hey, we're seeing something here that looks like potentially training might be a resolution to it. They submit a request to evaluate it specifically for that. So the performance improvement roll-up process hasn't been giving us the kind of source input that we've been looking for in the past. So that's being improved at this point as well. We also asked the departments to not only do a benchmark of their training programs with another power plant in the industry, again, reaching out so we're not isolated, but also to participate in industry mock boards. So ask to be a participant on one of these boards. So in that case, I, for example, would travel to, say, South Texas Project if they're getting ready for a board visit, and I would sit on their board as one of the individuals that I just mentioned earlier, XNRC, et cetera. But it provides practice for them to get prepared for the actual board. And for the individuals like ourselves that travel to do that, great experience also in understanding what kind of issues other training programs are having, but at the same time helping us prepare for an eventual board visit ourselves. Really great opportunity. Okay, so that's basically the plan in a big picture description. So the intent of it really was twofold. One, it was to raise awareness of the fact that, okay, it's maintenance and technical training's turn now to really focus hard on preparation for the accreditation renewal. And then it was also used as a kind of a bridging strategy to help us get from that critique that was done on the plane flight back from the ops training program board visit to bring us up into the point where we've got this document here now that's going to help us get through the rest of the 12 to 14 months before the accredited team visit happens. Okay. This slide here is just a cover sheet of the accreditation renewal process document that we have. We sponsored the creation of this document through a lot of discussion back and forth with our STARS partners, and ultimately they agreed that this is the document that they want to put their name on also. So the entire STARS group now will use this document as the guiding document to help them prepare fully for the entire accreditation review process. Okay, so in this document, it's a big fat document. It's about 80 pages. The main sections of it speak specifically to maintenance of our accreditation, right? That's a big deal. And the three main sections that I kind of touched on already are the ACER development or our owners. So it makes it very structured and consistent approach to working your way through making sure that you're getting the things done in a very timely manner. Okay, next slide. This is just an example here of one of the pages of the multiple attachments, and it's hard to see, but my point was to show you that the first line item on there, it begins at the T-minus 18-month point. So it starts way early in the process to ensure that we've got plenty of time to fully prepare for this whole effort.
And that training manager on there is you?
Yes.
So all of this, the buck stops with you. I mean, you're the manager of the whole thing.
I am the maintenance and tech training manager. I report to the training director.
I understand, but
for this program, yes. Okay, this is an updated version of that worksheet or that checklist, which has all of our specific detail in it. And the point of this slide was to show you that we've completed the first five actions on there, and the next action will be to have the ACER draft, the first rev of the draft, ready by the end of January of this coming year. So that's a very aggressive role or approach, but we're confident that we can get that done and that we need to do that to allow for adequate time for review and revision as appropriate. Okay, that brings us to the results achieved. Okay, so is this a lot of talk, a lot of plans, a lot of documents? Is it really doing anything for us? I say yes. If you look at the slide there, one of the first things that we've seen is there is a heightened awareness now in the training committees, which is the first place that we want to see it start. One example of that is the training oversight committee actually reviews the accreditation team visit preps now. It's a standard agenda item. So every time they meet, which is minimally quarterly, they'll be looking at the progress being made and have an opportunity to weigh in on that. We're also seeing a lower threshold for evaluating issues for training solutions, which is one of the things that we specifically were targeting. The example there is a mechanical maintenance group performed training specifically to improve their performance following the spring outage, where they saw a beginning of a trend of low-level rework activities, and this outage will be the measurement of how effective that training was. The point to make there is that that was an opportunity that they identified at a very low level, which is where we want to see that begin. The next bullet on there is process clarification through written guidance. We now have written guidance that describes this whole process for us, so that speaks very well to the sustainability of our efforts. Okay, we've got it in writing. There's no more guessing or wondering if Joe's got that and Kevin was the one that maybe had talked about it. We also have alignment with our STARS partners on the document that we co-created with them, and we also use them heavily for peer review of things like our self-assessment reports, any station-identified findings that we think we would like them to weigh in on. We use them frequently. I participate in a biweekly phone call with my STARS peers as well, so we have an opportunity to discuss what's working well for you guys, what kind of issues are you having, and then that follows up with a training director peer conference call as well. So my boss's peers get together also on every other week basis. So all that being said, the ongoing monitoring of this effort will be primarily through the training committees. So again, we have a three-tiered recognized strong training programs are critical to the safe operation of the power plant. There's no question about that. We also currently have strong accredited training programs, which we are required to have. We have now sustainable accreditation renewal process guidance to help us maintain those programs or maintain the accreditation of those programs. And then lastly, and very important, I think, also, is we use industry peer involvement a lot in lots of different activities to help guard against isolationism, right? We're out here by ourselves on the West Coast. And if you aren't continually reaching out and looking elsewhere to see what's going on in the industry, you could very easily get caught up in just doing what's going on here and not be aware of issues that are happening elsewhere and also not being aware of industry best practices. So we focus hard on that industry involvement in multiple aspects.
That's a good report.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Mr. Hawker.
Yes.
Before you leave the podium, may I ask you, in your view, what are the essential features of a successful training program?
The biggest piece, in my mind, is clearly the involvement by the students themselves. And so that's why we focus really hard on those curriculum review committee meetings that I talked about, making sure there's adequate representation by the incumbents or the individuals that are the students, the machinists, the mechanics, the INC technicians, the operators. They're the ones that need to be present at that meeting to weigh in on what they believe is the training that they need. That's where it starts right there. And so with active involvement by those individuals, by that group in each one of the disciplines, that's the beginning of a very effective training process. And then it gets back to the whole ADDIE concept, right? The analyze, design, develop, and implement, and then evaluate. The evaluate piece at the very end, that's really important also because that comes back to the very beginning. You're looking at how well did we do and feeding that back into the process to make corrections as needed.
So you don't subscribe to the old theory of you cannot teach old dogs new tricks.
No, I don't. There aren't any dogs employed out there. They're all people, and people learn new things every day.
That's wonderful response. Now, also, you do not subscribe to the U.S. Army training approaches, which, if I may describe, one of which was provided to me many, many years ago by a United States three-star general. The way he makes the soldier do things is, I cannot make any one of my soldiers do what I want him to do, but he would regret it.
That sounds like a little top-down approach there, huh?
And you don't do that here, right? You go down to the level, I don't mean down, you go to the level of the students, you motivate them, you make sure they know learning is part of the process.
The more involved they get with the whole process, the more receptive they'll be to the training, and the more it's going to sink in and ultimately help them back in the plant doing their job.
And the results are always measurable, right, in your program.
That's correct. That's the goal, is for it to be measurable so we can feed that back into the process.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jeff Harker was describing the fact, he first says it's a fact, that they have an accreditation requirement every 4 years, and he was describing how the plant goes about assuring that that accreditation process is successful for them, not because they want to pass the test, but because they want to achieve the excellent performance that makes the accreditation almost happen without.
We're not going to get.
Oh, that's a
please,
good question.
Please get all the questions on the record. Then we can answer them on the record. That's the only way we can get this on the transcript.
Who requires the accreditation?
Oh, I think I know the answer to that, and Jeff can fill us in. You could imagine the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would require accreditation and actually do it themselves, but instead, they require the accreditation but allow another organization to do the accreditation, and then they monitor that accrediting organization.
And the whole point is so that when you have a nuclear power plant, the people are trained properly and not in some ad hoc way.
Yes. I mean, a way of saying it is there are numerous places where the NRC requires something to happen, but instead of doing it themselves, they let an industry group do it, and then they monitor that to see that it's successful.
Right.
Because, well, bluntly, it's because for the NRC to have the expertise to do all that themselves would require much bigger staff than they either have or want to have. And doing it the industry way is much more effective because they're peers. I think that's a fair sort of description of why it's done that way. But it is required by the NRC that there be an accreditation program, and you got to pass it or you don't run.
Okay.
Am I right about that, Jeff?
And the accreditation team is people not only in the industry like the airline executive, but
yes,
retired people.
In answer to my question, the university people, someone from the airline industry, which is clearly related but different, in order to make a broader base.
And they come to the plant.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the way he described it was the accreditation board, which does a certification.
Oh, those are the five, yeah.
They, as he described it, designate a team that report to them that come to the plant and do all the investigations.
Okay.
Because we have 65 sites and 100 plants, and that board couldn't do it all. Okay.
So the team comes and helps the people get ready?
No, the team, crudely, administers the test.
Okay.
And they spend all this time preparing so they can pass it.
Okay.
But not just because they pass the test. I was once in third grade, and the whole point was to pass the test, not to learn. But he's trying to describe that they don't want to pass the test, they want to learn.
Right.
I mean, there is a distinction, I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is that a fair characterization, Jeff?
Okay. Additional public comment?
Having been a teacher for many years and gone through accreditation through the state of California, I'm curious about accreditation.
Please state your name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I always do this. Elizabeth Bruce, Mothers for Peace. And so with the accreditation for Diablo Canyon, if a person, the individual, passes the accreditation, would they then be able to go to
individual things about them that would require some additional things before you could move in? Not only he, but he's a maintenance trainer. A maintenance person on the diesel generators here couldn't just go to some other plant and start maintaining the diesels without specialized training, okay? The plants are similar but not identical.
Okay, so a person who's accredited here could not transfer.
Not automatically.
Not automatically transfer.
In this industry, people move around, and then they have to become retrained into whatever new position.
Mm-hmm.
With a lot of experience, it's not as difficult as you imagine, but it is not automatic for sure.
So is this an industry model for nuclear power plants?
That's fair.
Okay. As opposed to, you said it's a good industry plan.
That's fair.
But this is industry, a nuclear power model that we observe today.
That's fair.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Additional public comment?
That's good.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Gene Nelson, faculty member, Cuesta College, past faculty, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and member of Citizens for Green Nuclear Power. I'm very impressed as an educator with this process, and I really appreciate it. I just want to make sure that the committee notes that this is really a living process to make sure that lessons learned are incorporated and quickly disseminated throughout the organization, and also that the focus is on making sure it's comprehensive so that we don't make mistakes. In other words, once you've learned something, you want to make sure that somebody else doesn't repeat that same error. So, again, just it's a very well-thought-out system, and there actually is a interesting local connection. There's a company called Focus Learning, which is based right here in San Luis Obispo, and they were the real pioneer on developing this this ADDIE approach for high-consequence industries. They train both things like nuclear power plants and airlines and things like that. And again, and the plant works very closely with them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Additional public comment?
And, Dr. Nelson, I'll confirm I did get your email.
Very good. Okay, thank you. At this point, I'd like to thank our speakers from PG&E as well as the assistants from Cary Harbor in leading the session. We have some more items of business to conduct on our agenda. I do note that some of us have flights a little bit later in the afternoon that we'll hope to try to catch.
We'll
I think we're okay. So I have two items that I'd like to bring up. I think we'll do them in sequence, and they're ones that ultimately we'll need to decide whether we want to introduce motions and approve. One of them relates to the report that we discussed yesterday that we asked to be edited and modified and had directed Furman Wardell to do so. And then a second, which is probably simpler for us to do quickly, is a request to the Review Committee for Nuclear Fuel Power Plants, and this was mentioned earlier, or was mentioned yesterday by Roche, for the report to be edited, and now it's our time to review the edited report to make sure that it reflects accurately what we directed be done, and then we will discuss under my understanding, the state statute would not formally obligated to entertain public question, but in this case, I think we will also ask for public comment prior to making any motion to potentially approve or not approve this report. So at this point, I'd like to ask our consultant, Furman Wardell, to provide a summary of the editorial and substantive changes made to, well, the substantive changes made to the report in order to address recommendations from committee members yesterday.
Thank you. I'll be glad to. We have probably on the back table, do we, Bob, some copies of this document?
We do, and I would note for the record that the report in both versions, a clean version and a version showing all the changes to the report, were provided to members of the public at the same time they were provided to the members of the committee.
In this meeting?
At this meeting.
Right. So we have both the marked copy and a clean copy. I'm going to use the marked copy.
Speak up.
Mic's on.
Oh, yeah. Just closer to you.
Speak up. Okay. So I'll use the marked copy to go through. I'm not going to cover every little change, but I do want to focus on the Friends of the Earth submittal yesterday that we discussed with Bill Powers. Then we'll also discuss a couple of submittals and questions by the Mothers for Peace. Mm-hmm. I won't go into the background of this report. Pierre, you did a good job yesterday, I think, of doing that. So I'll pick up from yesterday and move forward, if I may. We have throughout the report referenced the Bill Powers, Friends of the Earth submittal on our report, and we've referenced that as reference 12. Those comments, our response to those comments by FOE, Friends of the Earth, start on page 4, about halfway down. And you can see the, if you have the marked version, which I hope you have, the blue wording underlined with the left-hand vertical bar shows the changes. Would you like me to go through each of these pair one by one? Or
I think that probably to summarize at a little higher level the major changes would be sufficient at this point.
Basically, they mentioned that the back in 2007 California Energy Commission workshop on nuclear safety, that NRC made the statements that they would defer to the state for decisions on whether to require cooling towers. We understood that, and Dr. Budnitz responded to that yesterday. We don't disagree with that, but we say here that, yes, the states do decide whether how the cooling is to be designed. However, the NRC still has the right and still will review the, whatever choice the cooling is made by the state for nuclear safety effects. So we've added that in here. Second paragraph to that, FOE stated it's unknown what practical experience committee members have, so I've included that here in the report to show. Friends of the Earth challenged our concern, stating there can be no operational risk when the plant is offline. Right, we understood that, and what we're saying here, the last sentence of that is the DCIC concern for Southern Construction on safety is primarily for the 6-year tie-in period when the plant would be fully operational. Their point was for the 2.3-year dual unit outage, all you have to worry about is spent fuel cooling. So that has our response is there to clarify what we really think. So I'm going to move on now to page 10. And here we are talking about, FOA Bill Powers brought up the Hope Creek nuclear plant, which he stated was a saltwater cooling tower plant, and said there's good information there that that plant is operating quite well. He said even better than Diablo Canyon. We did some research on this following that discussion yesterday, and we note that Hope Creek, yes, is a well-operating plant. It's a single-unit plant with a cooling tower, but it does not use salt water. It uses brackish water. And we realize there's a difference there. It's almost a factor of three. I didn't put that in the report, but a further research shows that the brackish water has about one-third the salinity level of seawater. So basically we're saying there we're still concerned that there's not enough information here and it's more motivation for further study. So just because that plant's operating well doesn't necessarily mean it's going to operate well here at Diablo Canyon with a higher salt content here. Page 13, again, we're talking about Hope Creek again, and it's a little more information here, and we added a reference 13 about the water being withdrawn at Hope Creek is from the Delaware River estuary and not from the ocean, and therefore is brackish and not salt water. Further down that page, Friends of the Earth suggested, and we agree, that any salt deposition study ought to take out the Diablo Canyon downfall or circulating water discharge if indeed that's going to be removed when cooling towers are put in. So we agree with that. Although we realize the impact of the downfall is much less than cooling towers would be here. Moving on to that's about it, basically. Those are the major changes. We did throughout the document, soften somewhat our conclusions about the impact of the cooling towers on nuclear safety. Rather than saying things will happen, we've backed off to say they're likely to happen or have the potential to happen. But we still keep our conclusion that further study is required on just about all these subjects. We feel like further information is needed, further analysis is needed. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bottom line. And I sent my write-up, which I did yesterday, out to the committee, asking for their comments back, only to me, not to each other, so we stay in.
I'm very comfortable with what Mr. Waddell had put together on this preliminary evaluation. However, Mr. Chairman, after listening to today's public comments and after listening carefully to Dr. Butner's reaction to my earlier proposed disclaimer, I now would like to make a proposal. May I first read to you what a proposed sentence I have to be inserted on page one of this latest preliminary report, okay?
Where on page one?
To be made into a one-sentence paragraph on page one. May I please read for the record?
Yes. Go ahead.
My proposal is DCISC, apostrophe S, charter is to review and make recommendations concerning the safety of operations at Diablo Canyon Power Plant, period, to be an independent third paragraph on page one. Mr. Chairman, my rationale is that I am sensitive to public comments, specifically three of them. One is this committee offered our evaluation and solicited and perhaps out of charter. Two, that this committee perhaps is perceived to be doing some other organization's bidding. Three, that this committee perhaps lacks independence. My sensitivity should be addressed in one stroke by this specific sentence to be inserted in there. So I respectfully request this proposal to be considered by the committee at this late hour.
I'll read it. The DCISC's charter is to review and make recommendations concerning the safety of operations at DCPP.
That's exactly right. I cannot argue against placing that statement of fact.
And in fact, where do you want to put it? At the end of paragraph two?
As a separate paragraph.
In between the second paragraph and the third paragraph, but it's a standalone one-sentence paragraph.
That is correct.
And as a simple statement of clear fact, I suspect it's acceptable for us to... It's
an accurate paraphrase of just what it is we are chartered to do.
Right, and it would address it directly, put it front and center.
That's fine.
In response to public comments.
And each of us would be able to point to this when we explain what our goals and motivation were in performing this study.
That's fine.
I agree.
I concur. So we've concurred in that, and that'll be that amendment that we will do.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Budnitz?
I have no further comments except to commend Furman for this excellent work done on a short fuse.
I have a few additional comments. The first is that I remain also sensitive to the same concerns that Peter has expressed. And so I'd like to reemphasize that in the course of performing our review, a very need for a license amendment review of the design. With respect to the question of using salt water for makeup, this for me raises significantly greater concern because we really don't appear to have a precedent for nuclear plants operating with such large sources of salt. The closest that we've identified, again, would be the Palo Verde plant. And it's a factor of 3 or 4 lower emissions of salt and also sits in a very different topography, has very different humidity conditions. I think it was inadvertent, but the Bill Powers' identification of the Hope Creek plant as being one that has employed salt water cooling towers appears to not be an accurate statement, and so we'll need to look into that further, but at least our initial investigation indicates that it operates with brackish water and that the circulating water may have, again, significantly lower circulating solids contents than we might expect to see in saltwater cooling towers at Diablo Canyon. During this meeting, therefore, we have already identified this as an important area for further investigation by our committee, and I believe that we should place a high priority on developing a better understanding of salt transport, deposition, impact on plant equipment reliability, particularly safety-related systems, and to do so on as fast of a basis as we can, because it could be helpful in informing decisions. I would note that while we were not charged, and it is not our direct expertise, to look at options that could reduce cost, I think it's important not to dismiss the possibility that reverse osmosis does not probably need to be quite so expensive, because this is not drinking water that you're attempting to produce here. You're just trying to get enough of the salt out so that you dump 900 tons a year out from the cooling tower. And that is a very different water quality level than what is needed if you're trying to produce drinking water.
On the other hand, that's not our remit, of course.
That's not our remit. And we weren't asked to try to comment on the economics or to comment on how you could design a cheaper cooling tower. But I just want to point out that in several areas, we have indicated that options which could be less expensive would probably not have safety impact. And in other areas, we continue to have substantive concern that these design approaches might actually have a sufficiently negative impact on plant safety that you'd question whether you'd want to do it that way. Then the final point that I would note is that given all of the information that we've collected to date, I think the position that that putting in cooling towers or making other modifications to the cooling system of the sort required here, as is concluded in this report, is very likely to require a license amendment review.
Which is what we said.
Which is what we said, and this is an area where we clearly disagree.
Evaluation.
I think that we've caveated.
That's what I thought so
sufficiently.
But we didn't take the flooding part out.
Yes, but the flooding part still is there as a potential safety risk. But yes. We said these have to be evaluated. I just wanted to point out that this falls into the category of risks which are.
So you're satisfied with this as it is in terms of that flooding issue?
I do have only one. I do have only one minor editorial comment, which is that instead, on page 13 in the new text, the bottom, I think it's an outfall, not a downfall, that we have at the plant. So if we could say outfall, not a downfall.
Good. Thank you.
What's the difference between the two?
I think our legal representative was advising me how to write this, and maybe that's the legal thing.
That's true.
So if we could, most of us have been calling it an outfall.
The word occurs twice in that paragraph.
That's correct. And so there's two places to correct it.
If it weren't corrected, I wouldn't bother me, but I accept that modest.
Although it does go down.
That modest terminology.
It does go down, but I defer to PG&E. What is it commonly called?
An outfall. Outfall.
Okay, thank you.
Outfall it is.
Before we do any comments,
it is the place. It is the
out and
right
fall
where it goes into the water.
Actually, if you think about it, downfall is sort of it's superfluous, or is it redundant? Right?
I think it's a better term. So.
Except for that other case of the upfall. Right?
So. Would you like me to discuss the two Mothers for Peace things first, or do that later?
No.
Or not discuss it at all?
With respect to the approval of the report, but at this point, I think what I'd like to do is before we have further discussion, I think we've gone far enough that it's the time for us to entertain again public comment, and so I would invite public comment at this time.
This is Dr. Gene Nelson, Cuesta College, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, PhD, radiation biophysics, electrical engineering background, and also water treatment background. And I very much appreciate Dr. Peterson making explicit mention that the flooding risk is likely to require an LAR. And, of course, we know that in the case of SONGS, that it was that requirement of an LAR that shut down San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. So I appreciate you bringing this issue up to that appropriately high level of attention that, indeed, this flooding risk, because the amounts of water that are required are really quite large. You don't just have a nice, neat little puddle in the bottom of a cooling tower. There are very large quantities of water moving at high velocity, and that I believe accelerates or increases, heightens my concerns regarding potential flooding in this proposed modification.
Thank you.
For your information, Dr. Nelson, that is not the only trigger for a license amendment request.
Yes, I understand that. Thank you.
Additional comments from members of the public?
No, so let's go.
Okay.
I want to move that the DCISC, if this motion passes, we will transmit it to the Water Sources Control Board, and it's the appropriate committee, and post it on our website as a public document. Okay.
I'll second Dr. Butner's motion.
Okay. Thank you.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The report is approved as amended.
Is there an issue with the transmittal letter, or is it merely straightforward? Here it is.
I'll ask counsel to describe how it is that we develop transmittal letters for reports.
We would develop the letter for the chair's signature.
But it's a straightforward. It basically says here it is.
Here it is.
No. I mean, there's no.
Yeah. Yeah, it's straightforward.
There's no issue.
It should be straightforward.
No.
Okay. The next item I'd like to entertain relate to the DCISC making a formal request to the Review Committee for Nuclear Fuel Power Plants to make their November 18th meeting available publicly by webcast.
I want to move that the DCISC make a written recommendation or request that meeting be publicly accessible by webcast.
I'll second Dr. Bettner's motion.
All in favor, please say aye.
If I could just offer one
question. Would be
the council has some advice.
The request, I think, to be specific, was that it be that the committee support a satellite location for the public webcast here in San Luis Obispo.
Okay.
Let me change that.
With with a satellite location.
Available in San Luis Obispo County.
I believe that was Ms. Becker's request.
Thank you.
I just wasn't as explicit. And then, by the way, before we vote on this, the mechanism would be that either you, the chair, or council will transmit that request and the motion we made to the appropriate place.
I will ask council to draft a letter that I can sign.
I'll second the motion as amended.
All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Yeah,
it is approved.
That's part of our general policy of trying to make everything we can possibly
as available. Transparent as possible. Right. Okay. So at this point, we're coming close to concluding or reaching the end of our agenda. I have items that we need to consider. Are there any future actions by the committee that we need to consider at this time?
Just to ask a question, Maureen Zawalik was going to get back to us, and she did informally about the schedule. There weren't any schedule issues where you said PG&E couldn't do it, in which case those dates that we had proposed were going to be tentative, at least for the moment, right?
Correct. They're tentative because I have an action to get all the emergency response drills and the NSOC dates,
I've not
been able to attain those yet.
That's right. Thank you.
And I think the three public meetings dates for next year were fine.
Mm-hmm. And then we had two changes to fact findings that you said were okay.
Yep, and those are confirmed fine. So it's just the confirming the fact findings in 2015 aligned with
2015. It was on the document that we received for the 12th and 13th, and that the station would check on whether it could be changed to the 19th and 20th of May. Is that right? That was.
Yes, I have that noted.
Okay, and that is correct.
That is correct. The other question was, what was the proposed November fact finding?
November of a year hence.
2015.
Yes,
sorry.
And that was for the 17th and 18th of November. Is that correct?
For 2015?
Yes.
Correct.
The 17th and 18th, and that's been?
And it was me and.
That's you and I.
Me and Lennon.
Right.
It was November 17, 18, 2015.
Right. And then May of this coming year was for Dr. Peterson and myself for the 19th and 20th of May. Great. So didn't matter to me. I just wanted to make sure that that's what they were.
I have one other item that I'd like to just raise for our consideration, which is that this public tour had substantially smaller number of people attend than we have had in the past. And I think that that might be attributable in part to the fact that PG&E over the last year has greatly increased the frequency of the public tours that it sponsors separately from ours. And it is possible that the pool of people who are interested in touring the plant is being depleted by PG&E's very commendable increase in sponsoring of tours. Furthermore, those tours include access into the protected area, which is also something that was done pre-9/11 but is a major step forward. So I think that we need, not that we should solve it here, but that we'll want to think through the question of what we should be doing in the future with public tours that the DCISC might sponsor, and that we may want to experiment a little bit with somewhat different formats, but that is something I believe that we can work out
and planning for the agenda of our next meeting.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. So let me make a specific proposal. And this is an assignment for the for council, but it's only a letter to write, and or maybe it'll go to Maureen. Could we have a tabulation of the explicit tours that PG&E is now doing publicly by date, and how many people have going, so that we can tabulate? The way I phrased it was, if in the last 4 months, between June when our last one was and now, PG&E brought 5,000 people over there, I'm just pretending, and we're bringing 30 or 40 more, then we're now a drop in the bucket compared to when we were bringing 30 or 40 and there was nobody else was doing anything. On the other hand, if PG&E is only bringing 100 people and we're bringing 30 or 40 more, why, we're not a drop in the bucket. It's still an important thing. And
correct.
We'd sort of like to know the data. Without arguing for a minute that all of us are commending PG&E that finally, years after 9/11, they're finally doing this because they had been at first enjoined from doing it, and then finally it's doing.
Okay. That information would be very helpful for us in terms of planning what we should be doing with respect to our broader program of public outreach. So I just wanted to raise that as a potential as something we'll need to be thinking about. I think we've already confirmed future site visits as well as public. We don't have these great experts coming along from the DCISC to educate members of the public about and answer any question that they might have.
Well, then, don't give it up. Hey, keep them going.
But to confirm back, Per, I will get that information, and we can look at some changes in the tour.
We're not saying we're going to give it up. We just want to collect the data.
Right. We have an obligation under our charter for public outreach, and we want to make sure that we're fulfilling it as effectively as possible. This has been one element of what we've been doing. But clearly, if we're getting reduced attendance, we need to understand why.
Maybe we
and make sure that we're
something.
That what we're doing is actually adding value from the perspective of public outreach. I do think that there is some value in having these more independent tours with some independent expert participation. But we should evaluate that given the fact that commendably PG&E has greatly increased its access for public tours to the plant.
I just want to make sure, because I had a little, maybe it was just me, but I had a little confusion here with all the dates going around. The meeting for the special studies group by the State Water Resources Control Board is Tuesday, November 18th. I wanted to make sure that date. I think I heard the 17th, or maybe I thought.
Hold on.
I think it is.
It is the 18th.
Hold on.
I have the notice.
Correct. It is Tuesday the 18th.
That's correct.
If there was anything else said by me, it was an error.
Okay. 18th. The number 17 was used on a few occasions.
But
the 18th is the correct date. Okay. Absent any other business, what I'd like to do now.
I got something else to say.
Okay.
I have just learned that tomorrow at noon California time, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is going to release the safety evaluation report for the underground safety evaluation of Yucca Mountain, which has been under wraps for 4 years, and which I have been led to believe says, in plain English, we reviewed it and we don't have any problem with it. We'll see. But it's coming out tomorrow, having been under wraps since Chairman Jasko buried it about 4 years ago.
Actually, he compelled the staff to redact all of their conclusions from the report.
It's coming out tomorrow.
And issue a report with all conclusions redacted.
Right, and so the reason I'm calling the public's attention to that is it will be available. I just have an email. It will be available on the NRC's website at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, which is noon tomorrow, our time. And anybody who's interested in that safety evaluation of the Yucca Mountain thing, it's out there in the public, okay?
But are you saying it's all redacted?
No.
It's being released.
Oh, it's not redacted.
Right.
It was unredacted
version.
It was issued in a redacted form. At this point, what I'd like to do is to thank PG&E again for your help in organizing and supporting our meeting.
Tell the public they can get it.
We also appreciate AGP Video for their great work in making sure that it gets broadcast and it's available publicly, and we understand, as Bob was saying, that we've had some 39 people or so streaming over the web the meeting.
With those concluding remarks at this point, I can adjourn this.
No, you need a motion, which I will.